have a bit of an unorthodox training plan, but it involves some pretty vicious overtraining sequences.
It does.
And then in June, I barely run at all. So I follow up my overtraining with an overtaper.
And inevitably, again, you hope for this, that you're going to start feeling better as a result of that.
And so you just want to go down those hills as many times as you can for however many miles you can, over and over and over and over again until your quads are flat out immune to them.
There's John Nichols. And he just run, what did you run, a 20 hour something at Western States? And there he was running with the world's best at the 10K. It was, I tell y'all, it was quite a scene.
Did he have a shirt on? Did they make him wear a
shirt?
They did. They did?
Yeah. I almost didn't recognize him for that reason alone. But when I saw the gate, I knew it was him.
Welcome, and thanks for joining Trail Runner Nation. I'm Scott Warr.
I'm Don Freeman.
And we are here today with Lee McKinley and John Nichols. Between the two of them, they are well qualified to come on the program today. They have over 150 ultras in the bag. They've both run combined over 1,600 milers, and each of them combined have done 11 Western States 100s.
Wait, Scott, I'm confused. They've done 1,600-mile runs or 1,600 100-mile runs?
Yes.
Which one?
The latter.
Oh, got it.
Makes me tired just thinking about that stat.
You know, who better to bring on than guys that have done it? And race strategy is just so, so important. There's so many ways to run a race. And these guys have practiced enough and tried different methods and have come up with what has proven to be pretty successful for them.
I agree. And you know, I'm still fairly new in this ultra scene. I still make mistakes on race strategy.
No.
I think I can go
really?
Out there really fast and, you know, try to get ahead of everybody, and that's going to pay off. It's going to bank my time so that I don't need to run real fast at the end. We're finding, and we'll find out today, if that's the right strategy to have.
So welcome Lee McKinley, who's been on the show before. He was on with Jimmy Dean Freeman into Ultra or Not to Ultra, and then his own segment as he was a featured guest with Cross Training. So thanks, Lee, for coming back.
Thank you very much. It's great to be back.
John Nichols, great to have you here. I have a John Nichols story, too, so we're happy to have you here, John.
Is this one it's you can tell?
Yeah, it's nothing but ugly, vicious truth.
Well, the first I learned of John Nichols on the trail was he was the guy wearing a set of headphones with no shirt. And somebody said, well, you know who John is? Like, no, I don't know who John is. You know, the guy with no shirt. That's the guy.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that guy. Is that right, Lee?
Am I? Yeah, I instantly knew the guy. Yeah. Yep. No nipple chafing going on there.
No.
Why no shirt, John? Was there a reason?
No, the nipple chafing certainly is an element of that, but I actually sweat very little. And so I really am reliant on the wind going across to cool my radiator.
Good. Now we know. What temperature does it require a shirt for you? I mean, there's a certain number in your head, and you know what it is.
Require, I would say anything under 40, most often anything under 50, but I will go without a shirt before I go without gloves.
Wow.
I have bad hands. I'll wear two pairs of gloves sometimes.
And no shirt. No shirt, two gloves.
Well, and if you had a body like John, you know, you got to take your shirt off.
I
can't take my shirt off.
If I had a body, if I had a body like John's, I'd just wear a tie to work. So, John, thanks for being here. And the story I have about John, besides the shirt, that wasn't my only story. That was just a little piece about his personality, is this. You know, and Lee, you were on your 41st birthday or 40th birthday, John? We had to do a 40-mile run, I think, in January, and he
you're
organized
right.
it, right?
You're right. You're right. I remember that being a very ugly day in terms of the weather, and not to mention extremely long day for January.
Mm-hmm. And longer for some than others, and it was long for you and I, Lee. But I know that at one point at, was it Goat Hill? That there was a wonderful container down there that was, and the run started early. It was an early morning run, but John had already been up and pulled a large plastic container full of everything. It was full of
goodies.
Oh yeah, it was every bit of an aid station that you'd see at a good race. It had everything in it that you could dream of for an ultra runner. So that was, it was pretty nice to see that that far into the run.
And so, you know, John's just that kind of guy, you know, that shows up with all of that stuff. There were socks in there. There was a pair of socks.
Really?
Wasn't there, John?
Yeah, there was, you know, hemlock if you needed it.
There was everything in there. So John's just one of those great guys. And so it's nice to have him here today. One of the things that John has written, just a wonderful race report. He's done, how many times have you done Western States, John?
Seven times.
And in again next year.
And so he has a lot of experience with that race and with race strategy. One of the things that he's kind of coined the phrase rabbit hunting. And I know we're sitting in front of two rabbit hunters, actually. And as that term unfolds, I think these guys will share with us just exactly how they do it and what it is and how it's successful for them. I want to just start this race report. And I hate to read things on this podcast, but guys, I've got to read it. And John has allowed us to post this wonderful report on the podcast. So you'll be able to find it on trailrunnernation.com. Right under his podcast, you'll get a link to this and you'll be able to download it. And he writes this at the beginning of June 26, 2010, Western States Report by John Nichols. He says, rabbit hunting is shorthand for race strategy I employ at Western States. My approach is to make good time through the high country while eating, drinking, and running efficiently. I like to get to Robinson's Flat at mile 30, up about 4 to 5 pounds, so that I have a margin of error later in the day. As I enter the heat of the day through the canyons over the next 25 miles, my primary focus is pounding ice water down into my gut and on my head so that I keep the core body temperature under control, particularly during the more challenging switchback climbs. Once I emerge from the canyons at Michigan Bluff, mile 55, I do a calculation on how much daylight remains. It is at this point where I go ahead and put myself into physical jeopardy in order to maximize how much of the course I can cover before it gets dark. Leaving Forest Hill at mile 62, I pick up my pacer, and if I've still got wheels, we go rabbit hunting. In other words, we go looking for more talented runners who got excited and made a mistake in the canyons. Rabbit hunting usually goes on for about 20 miles. Then, the last 4 to 5 hours is a matter of grinding it out to the finish line and hopefully securing a silver buckle. Well written, and really just describes the race so well.
Exceptionally well written.
John, tell us about rabbit hunting.
Well, I think the key is to run as efficiently and quickly as you can in the early part of the day when it's still fairly cool. But be cognizant of the temperature. If it's getting anywhere near 100 degrees, you need to be prepared to back off a bit as you're going through the canyons. And then I do indicate it does get significantly more difficult to run when it gets dark. So if the sun starts getting low in the sky, take 3 hours, and it's okay to redline it at that point. And it is an awful lot of fun to see if you can, again, go chase down some of those more talented runners before you just have to do the ugly things that's required to hold your time together during the hours. You know, I think in the 2010 race in particular, it was fun where I actually did manage to catch Lee. I've been chasing Lee at races at pretty much all distances, and I've gotten close a few times. I'm usually unable to sustain it. This time I caught him and I went by him pretty quick, and I thought, usually once I catch somebody that late in the race, it's unlikely they're going to catch me back. But Lee, he's not just a rabbit hunter. He's a rabbit and a hunter.
And patronizing will get you nowhere.
Yeah.
I can't wait to the next race where you kick my butt.
Yeah. So he was the one who went. He was the rabbit who was hunting Elmer's, and he came and he ran away from me late in the night, and I was unable to stay with him.
Well, and might I add, this is Lee. I really enjoyed how John was able to weave the section where he and I came together in Western States and kind of ran together for a while. And actually, I had this particular race that you referred to, 2010, I had lost my pacer. And so it was a lonely time to catch up with John and talk a little bit about how our strategies had worked up to that point in the race. Really helped a lot. So it's a great read, by the way, if you get a chance to check that out on the website.
And creative too. I mean, he has movie quotes through there, and just it's great. I've read it a couple times.
You know, the interesting thing about it, and where we want to get to the crux of this is he makes light of the whole thing, but it's broken into sections. When you do these long races, you've got to break it into sections. Let's talk about that. I mean, how do you break it into sections? I mean, I remember many races where I'd go out and try to get ahead of everybody, thinking that I could bank time. And
what about the bank time theory?
It doesn't work, right?
Guys, go at it.
Let me jump in there. Now, I think John and my philosophy toward running these 100 miles is very much the same. I think we get to the end result the same way, but our tactics are different. He just gave some very specific kind of detailed things that he points to in terms of whether or not it's hot out, chewing the ice, etc. I think I keep it at a higher level when I race, but I do say, and I stick to this in the 100 miles, is I say that for the first 70 miles, I'm just going to go easy. And that definition of easy for me, as we've talked about on a previous podcast, is going at or below 70% of effort. And that doesn't matter if I'm going up a climb or going down an easy downhill. I'm just keeping it nice and easy, because I know I'm going to suffer greatly, regardless of if I go easy or not during those early miles. I'm going to suffer enough for the entire race in that last 30 miles.
Did you just say the first 70 are easy miles?
How about relatively?
Okay.
Yeah. I'd almost describe, I think, what you're trying to do for maybe even the first 70 is run as fast as you possibly can without using any muscles. You know, it's like, you know, it's kind of like just at the edge, but you're just running as fast as you can without pushing, because if you go into any kind of debt or deficit early part of the race, you will pay severely for that later. And that 10 minutes you banked, you're gonna have to pay an hour back, and so there's quite the multiple. So you want to run kind of just up to that edge, to where you're running as efficiently and as fast, you're making good time. But avoid tipping over that edge to where you are going to pay it all back tenfold later on.
Right. Now, and let me throw this in too, that all of what we're saying so far, I think, seems like pretty obvious advice or obvious tactics. But I'd be interested in your all feedback on what you see race day when it actually gets to the starting line. Everybody's all hyped up. They've been tapering for 3 weeks. I can count in the dozens the number of runners that are, shall I say, of average talent, who go out with the lead pack and really are just not even cognizant of the fact that they're doing that. And it's just because they're racing on feel at that point. And as John said, you know, that going redlining at that point, even though you may not feel like you are, you're going to suffer greatly toward the end.
You know, let's talk about that. I mean, we have a lot of new runners that are listening to this podcast that are getting out there and, you know, still learning how to do this. How do you slow yourself down at the beginning of the race? You have this adrenaline going. People take off and the talented ones are kind of, you know, taking it easy. And yet you may not be as talented like me. And I may say, hey, I can stay up with these guys when I know that I shouldn't be. How do you control that?
Yeah, I think you just have to have a very conscious view of keeping that throttle turned back just enough to where you're making good time, but you're avoiding building that deficit that is going to create problems for you later on.
You know, and I'll add to that some tactics, because I've learned too that it's difficult. It's easier said than done. But little things we've talked about on the podcast before, including holding back on caffeine. You know, deciding you're not going to take that caffeine till later in the race, holding back on music for me works till later in the race, because if I turn that music on too early, I'm going to go that much faster. So any tactics that will help me mentally grab on to that concept of slowing down like that work.
I think that you've said before also that a heart rate monitor helps. If you're using a heart rate monitor, you can keep your heart rate at a certain level. I have a Garmin watch that has a virtual pacer that I can put in what pace I need to be going those first few.
Great idea.
And that holds me back.
Yep. It allows you to allows for the discipline to sit on the Garmin watch rather than in your mind. So
right.
All you have to do is look at that little pace guy. That's a great idea.
Yeah, I really try to pay very little attention to the actual time until I hit Michigan Bluff at mile 55.
Oh, really?
At that point, you can say, I got approximately 10 hours to go, and then you start charting your target time. Mm-hmm. But early on, pretty much what Lee was saying, you've got a target being that 70% being efficient in fueling and everything else you need to do so that you are ready to really begin the race at Michigan.
You know, I want to get back to that 70%. One of my favorite topics really is at 70%, and we talk about it, but what is it? You know, now we're at the feet of two elite athletes, and I think we can talk to them about how do you find, what do you monitor, how do you practice? And it comes with experience, I get it, but what can we do on a trail? What can we read and watch in our bodies to get that 70%? What is it?
And the only way I do it is what I said a touch earlier, is try to run without using your quads. If you're pushing at all, you're making a mistake. Mm-hmm. But if you're just kind of trying to keep the wheels turning as fast as you can without actually pushing, then you're just trying to achieve that efficiency, and I think that approximates the 70%.
So let's talk about like lactic acid. You know, when you're starting to feel a burn in the quads, that's, you're reaching deeper than you should for that time.
That's
a big
time mistake early on.
So if you're climbing a hill and you're doing some running and you're feeling some of those quad burns or hamstring or calves, you're starting to reach in an area that you could slide, you know, backwards in that deficit that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Agree?
Yep.
Lee?
Yep. Here's another tactic that I've used, and now specific to the 100 miles, it really is a different deal in a 50 or a 50K. But to decide at the start of the race that I am going to start with, well, let me step back a moment. Being in the community for a while, you have an idea of what other runners are capable of doing. And so if I seed myself in the beginning of the race with runners that I know that are slower than I am, it becomes a very easy way to hold back, because I run with that group for the first, say, 30 miles, knowing that if I run with that group, I'm running well within myself. Does that make sense?
It does. As long as you pick the right people that are running slow. I mean, they may be slower runners, but yep, guys like me, you'll take off like a rabbit out of it. You don't want to stay with me in the first, because then you're going to be running too fast.
I'll be watching you in the next race. I'll be watching you head out ahead of me.
We'll be doing some rabbit hunting later.
Yeah, that's right.
I am a rabbit.
And if you talk about kind of the sections, I think the sections really start off in your training. Without going into too much detail, it's I do have a bit of an unorthodox training plan, but it involves some pretty vicious overtraining sequences.
It does.
And then in June, I barely run at all. So I follow up my overtraining with an overtaper. So every once in a while, some folks look at it and think it appears somewhat extreme, particularly for a first-time 100-miler. But I think it's psychologically important, particularly for a first-time 100-miler, to hit, say, Michigan Bluff at mile 55 after you've been through the canyons and maybe the most devastatingly difficult 55 miles you've ever run in your life. Mm-hmm. And if you pop out of there and say, you know, I felt a lot worse during the spring.
Yeah. Right.
And it's a huge amount of confidence. Whereas you get some folks who hit that thing and they got 45 miles to go and they're scared.
Right.
They're scared because they've just been through something really awful. And that sun's starting to set in the sky. And it's a fairly emotional thing to think about what you have in front of you. But right. If you get up there and think, you know, I felt much worse in some of those training sessions, it's time to start rabbit hunting, it gets downright fun.
You know, I tell you, John, you're helping me visually put myself right there at Michigan Bluff. And I've been in both situations where maybe I've come in there pretty fast in terms of time, but I don't feel well. And that is a much worse place to be, in my opinion, than to possibly be a little bit slower, but be mentally together and to say, you know what, bring it on, you know, to think that you've got it left for that next 55 miles. And to me, that mental game that you're describing there, that you're playing with yourself to get to Michigan Bluff, regardless of how much time it takes to get there, to feel good about it at that point, that's going to be a huge dividend.
You bet. Lee, do you think that's you could apply that same philosophy to any 100-mile race, or is that just specific to Western states?
Oh, no, absolutely to all races. Now, I don't know necessarily about that particular spot, but, you know, like Angeles Crest, I'm thinking
Chantry.
Thank you, Chantry. Yeah,
I'll never forget Chantry. Yes.
Do we need to bring up that suffering at Chantry? Get me out of the cot.
My psychologist appreciates that.
Yeah.
Another session.
I think where it's particularly important at Western States is that first 50 miles is so difficult. And if you get to the last 38 miles from Four Oxtail on in, it's pretty runnable. If you've got preserved your quads at all and you can make up a lot of time. You know, you got 30, 40, 50 miles to play with. You can make up a whole lot of time. It is a flat-out runnable course, but the first 55 can take you out of the race if you don't protect yourself.
Right, right. Hey, you know, something, that, if you don't mind me jumping in here.
Yeah, that's why you're here.
We're talking about tactics and things that work, and you all, or many of the listeners may know a name, Kevin Sawchuk. He's run 10 Western States, I think all of them under 24. One thing that he would do is the day before the race, he would go out and he'd stack rocks. You know how they will stack rocks on top of one another for
hoodoos,
ducks. They call them in backpacking. Oh, yeah, uh-huh. Or hoodoos. So he'd put one of those up at one point in the race, and that would mentally draw himself to that spot in the race, having put those out before the race. So again, this is a mental game we're talking about. But for him, it worked, and so. Maybe it comes down to finding what works for you as a runner and then latching onto that. It's going to be different for everybody.
I've got a cool thing along those lines. And it was the time I ran Western States, and Bob Powers, my pacer, a local great runner and just a great guy, he went to the very last ribbon and he pulled half of it off, and then he brought it to me at work. And he says, "This is the last ribbon on your course that you'll be running Saturday morning."
That's
and he handed
cool.
it to me. He said, "Put it in your pack and we'll return it. At the end of the race."
Oh,
it was
great.
So awesome. It was it empowered me. It gives me chills just thinking about it. John, I like that point. We talk about 70%, but you're using another term now, and I think it's good for discussion, the edge. Running on the edge, because if you are going to run your personal best that day, you have to find that edge. You can't go over it, or you slide down and you can't catch up. You may bonk and just blow your race up. But if you're too far on the other side of the edge, then you never reach your potential that day. And so running to the edge is really why I like the sport. I like feeling it out there and messing with the different, my pace, fuel, whatever it might be, gear that I'm wearing to keep me on that edge and all day manipulating things to keep the edge.
So can you practice that in your training? Pushing yourself to the edge, or is that just a training, a race day?
I mean, you can certainly practice running difficult courses when your legs are and the rest of you are fairly severely compromised. You can test out that part of it, but I think there's the part of it, race day, is where it'd be an oversimplification to just think you go out slow and finish fast.
It
really is kind of running as quick as you can through different stages while preserving your ability to maximize your time during the last 40 miles. And I think that does involve sometimes going out relatively quick to avoid crowds in the whether it's the snow or some of the early single track. It may involve making some pretty good time before noon when it's still relatively cool. It may involve backing it off when it gets over 100 degrees and laying up, so to speak, so that you get a chance to run faster when the sun starts to set again. It may involve backing it off, but then again, speeding it up when you know you've got 3 hours of daylight and you want to maximize your time before it gets dark, and maybe you're going to regroup at that time. And I've also found in my own particular circumstance, my brain's good for about 21 hours. You know, so whether I'm on track to break 21 hours or get close to it, I'm in pretty good shape. But even if I was on a day, whether it's hotter or I'm running slower, my brain's still only good for, I get kind of flaky after 21 hours, so I might as well maximize the amount of ground I can cover in 21 hours,
John,
and then I get floopy.
I've seen you. You're good for 18 hours, my friend.
His self-assessment was 21, but his friends say 18.
That's great.
You know, so all those things you were talking about was the edge of playing with that. And sometimes with the edge, and comment, guys, you're allowed to go over the edge a little bit if you know what's coming up, if you know the course well enough, if you know it's going to be the downhills. You're shaking your head, Lee. You're not agreeing with this?
I think that going back to what both John and I agreed to earlier is that each time that we go up against that that point where we're pushing hard means that we're going to pay back that later in the race. So whenever, and again, this is just for me, but
sure,
whenever I reach that point where I'm going over that 70%, I have to make a conscious decision at that point. Am I willing to go over it at that point,
mm-hmm,
knowing that it's going to mean that I'm going to have to give something up on the back end, but I don't go over that 70% thinking, hey, you know what? This is going to be a freebie. I'm just going to be able to keep pushing.
There's no free, no free lunch.
Well, that's from my experience.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's my experience also. I think where, you know, Don, I guess, you know, may have a bit of a different recollection because, what is it? I don't know how many years back you ran like 2020 or something at Western States, or
I'll take it because that was faster.
Fast.
Yeah, no, yeah. It was 2040 or something like that. Yeah,
yeah, and so it was a kind of a banister day for you. Just kind of ran out of your mind that day. It was an amazing, amazing race. When you have that perfect day, most of the rules you can throw out the window, right? And so we're talking about the rules you would apply in any normal day. You just ran out of your mind that day, and so you ran so crazy fast, you probably got away with all sorts of stuff just because you were on.
Is that how you define that day? Is that did you see that coming, that 2040?
No, I was surprised. I think it was Brown's Bar when I learned that, you know, things were magically coming together. I was just, you know, trying to run efficiently out there and practicing the 70% thing. And so when I say go over the edge, maybe I meant only 71%. Maybe that's just sneaking a little bit, guys. Since I got shot down, I'm like going over the edge.
No, I think when you run a race that fast, sometimes it just magic happens, and the lessons learned on that day may or may not be applicable to normal days.
Yeah.
You know what? I don't know if this is diverting too much from the topic, but John started in on something that I want to hear about,
yeah,
and it may tie into how hard to push, and that's your unique training. And so I don't know if we're going to have time for that
in
this podcast.
Yeah, we have time.
Go for it. I think we all have something to learn about how you train, and maybe there'll be something I pick up on my next 100 listening to what you have to say.
What I do in the winter months is I get up around 90 to 100 miles a week. Okay, and some folks might think that's a little bit too early, but I actually find it's more viable to do that kind of mileage, mm-hmm, when it's fairly cool. Mm-hmm. Okay, mm-hmm, and then you get into the spring months, mm-hmm, and I'm going to do a lot of different events. Some people call them races, but I kind of do all of them, and I'm perfectly content being maybe 2 hours behind somebody in a 50 miler who I might be 4 hours ahead in the 100 miler. Mm-hmm. I run a lot of these events, and I'm perfectly satisfied posting a pathetic time.
And now details. Now you'll run 50 milers every weekend. Is that something? I'm remembering something like that.
Yeah,
pretty close. Sometimes, like last year, I did like 9 50 milers in 10 weeks.
Wow.
Some of that was due to the snow levels and the inability to get into the canyons. Right. So, and then in the April and May, I really want to spend a lot of time in the canyons. It's if you think about Western States, it's all about the downhills. It's all about the heat and the downhills. And so you just want to go down those hills as many times as you can for however many miles you can, over and over and over and over again until your quads are flat out immune to them. And then in June, I back it way off for 3 to 4 weeks to where I run very little.
Hmm.
Except I will, if I had to take Western States, it's two biggest variables are the downhills and the heat. I mean, you can try to train for everything, but what can you do?
Mm-hmm.
If you conquer the downhills and you conquer the heat, you're in a good place to be. It's kind of hard to train for the heat oftentimes if it stays cool during the spring.
Right.
So June is taper and sitting in the sauna for an hour, hour and a half at a time in, mm-hmm, different sets of actually sitting in the sauna. And,
mm-hmm,
and sometimes me and a training partner or two will even go run around Lake Natomas in three layers of sweats. We look like we're leading a trail. So my mileage is going to drop way down, but I may just run in the sweats for a few weeks just to heat acclimate. So I'm going to get the downhill squared. I'm going to heat acclimate, but I'm going to be very, very tapered,
yep,
after a number of months of arguably overtraining. But that means I'm doing these events, meaning I may go.
You're backing off during the events.
Though, yeah, so I'm just running badly. Right? Mm-hmm. I was the last official finisher at the Jed Smith 50 miler last year.
Mm-hmm.
I felt so bad at 35 miles, I went and took a nap in my car for 30 minutes and then finished the race. It's like,
is that right?
But I'm just going to get it in and use them as events with aid stations as,
right,
part of the training, rather than thinking I need to do anything other than a step towards that one day where I'm going to try to run faster than I should.
The concept of time on the legs being more important than high quality shorter runs.
Which I think I'm, so, I'm and it's a strategy that I employ in part because, you know, if you talk to some of the faster runners like the Mark Lance and Eric Skaden, who you may have on next time around, they run some of these, they run at speeds I'm unable to match in training. So sometimes you would be better off running some of these distances shorter and faster. I found that the height of my training, I'm simply unable to do that. Mm-hmm. So I've had to adapt my training to my physical limitations where those guys are playing with some different tools.
I have some footprints from both Eric and Mark on my back if you want to see what kind of shoes they wear and what size.
Yeah, yeah. You try to stay with those guys too much. And yeah, I've tried to stay with them on some of those switchback climbs, and it's like 15 minutes into it, they cracked me open like a soft peanut. And I just kind of had... forfeited.
Like a soft peanut.
It's not pretty.
You're very good.
I'd like to get back to how do you break up a long run and execute a good race? We've been talking a lot about Western States. Very few people are actually going to have the ability to win in the lottery and get in and run Western States. But for those that are listening to the podcast, can we generalize or come up with a theory on they're planning to do a 100-mile race. They're looking at the elevation gain and loss. How do they plan? How do they break that up so that they can motivate themselves throughout the day to finish the race?
Does that make sense? Can I take this one on, John? So I think, yeah, absolutely. Both mentally and physically, how to break it up.
Right.
And I think that there are many ways to slice that pie, and it's very race specific. So Western States, one way to look at it is, I think it was referred to earlier, is to look at it just from the perspective of the cool part of the day versus the hot part of the day, the light part of the day versus the dark part of the day. I know that only through experience of running several of these that my mental approach changes throughout the day. And so now that I have some idea of how it changes, I can adapt my running and how much effort I put into the running at that time of day based on how I know my lows are and my highs are mentally. So that's one approach. Another is, if you know the course, to decide, as John mentioned, to get to Michigan Bluff, that's going to be one target spot to get to, and that you're going to absolutely unequivocally not go over that 70% or whatever it is that you decide until you get to Michigan. And you can, you know, again, this may sound like a lot of cycle babble, but there is that feeling when you get there and you still have legs left that cannot, nothing can be greater than that feeling. And if you can get in that zone that allows you to feel like that when you get to mile 50 or 55, it cannot be stressed enough how important that is. So anyway, that's another way to approach it. John.
Yeah, my dad writes books on Eisenhower, and one of his aphorisms are that plans are worthless, but planning is essential, because it's the thinking through the race, thinking through the strategy is what helps you keep your head when something goes different than your plan, which is pretty early on. So you kind of have to have an overarching strategy that you're going to apply, but you have to expect that you're going to adjust and adapt to that plan very many times. And that's why you do break it up into sections. You think about what you're going to try to achieve in the morning, through the heat of the afternoon, through the canyons, and then you recalibrate you know, what your target time might be once you get to you know, more within striking distance of the finish line, at least within the 50-mile zone, to have a sense as to what the day might be ready to offer to you. But overall, if you think about, like, I do a lot of 5Ks and 10Ks and those types of things too, and the race strategy there is very different. You must flat out get out fast, and sometimes even faster than you're able to sustain. You get up around a half marathon, you need to be pretty even. You get up toward a marathon, you actually are better off with negative splits, because at some point you go off over that edge that Don was talking about, and you fill your legs up with a bunch of lactic acid and all sorts of other bad things. And if you're to choose which part of the race to damage your legs, it's the second half, right? You want to get there with enough wheels, even though you may finish with faster splits the second half. That's that strategy. And And you can just imagine in the 100 miler, if you went over that edge early, the amount of time you're going to have to run on damaged legs, you'll pay a big, big price for it. But as Lee was alluding to, you have to deal with the heat. You have to deal with when it gets dark. And it's really hard to run when it gets dark, even if you have nice headlamps. And so you do have a strategy that says maximize your daylight, maximize this. But you're very cognizant the whole way that if you go over that edge early on, you're going to pay a price for that, and you just have to be very, very cautious of that and when to decide when do you take that chance.
Could I?
Yeah.
Okay, so when we talk about the heat of the day, so if this topic is about Western States specifically, it is usually going to be warm during the day. Most of us mid-packers are going to be challenged by stomach problems. That's one of the things that, regardless of how well you train, inevitably stomach problems come up. So, again, a way to break it up is to think about, I'm going to try to control the stomach through the day. As that sun comes down, that becomes a big carrot to know that it's going to get cooler.
Sure.
And you're going to be able to start taking in those calories again. And inevitably, again, you hope for this, that you're going to start feeling better as a result of that. But allow me to interrupt myself and go back to something John said about the fact that he likes to run 5 and 10Ks. My wife Sarah and I happen to be going to the National Championship 10K that was held in Sacramento last summer. Is that the right, what it was called? National Championships? International
yeah.
Championships.
Yeah, World.
World Championships. So we went there actually.
Universe, I think.
Yes.
This make it bigger.
Right. It was a
galaxy.
It was the World Championships. So Sarah and I went there. It was 2 weeks after Western States. We went there to watch Kevin Sawchuk, who I brought up earlier, because he was running the 10K. So I'm watching the 10K, and who do I see line up at the start line? And y'all, this is 2 weeks after Western States. There's John Nichols, and he just run. What did you run, 20 hour, something at Western States? And there he was running with the world's best at the 10K. It was, I tell y'all, it was quite a scene.
Did he have a shirt on? Did they make him wear a shirt?
They did.
They did?
Yeah. I almost didn't recognize him for that reason alone. But when I saw the gait, I knew it was him.
It is. It then goes back to... You have to, when you're going to run a 10K with those groups, particularly that close to Western States, you're not going to get lapped, and you're going to get lapped twice. So you just have to be fine with that, right?
You know, that's right.
I got to keep Sawchuk from lapping me. But other than that, it's like it's going to be a little unpleasant. But I find the shorter races that close after Western States is actually a type of rehab. I get out in the track and just do intervals until I worked all the trail things out of my legs. You get into a more full range of motion when you run a little bit faster. And frankly, at that stage for at least a couple months, I'm not really into prolonged suffering, right? I must have made some mental deal with myself around mile 80 that if I just got through that, I wouldn't do anything that takes longer than an hour for about a month, right? So I'm doing 5Ks and 10Ks and things that let me stop in a reasonable period of time.
Yep.
Hey, if I could bring it back a little bit to staying motivated, and how do you break up a race, and also tie in part of our topic, which is rabbit hunting. And maybe this will make me the guy on the trail that people are going to throw rocks at now, but I want to talk about the motivation it does bring when you see a rabbit. And you're trailing behind, and you find somebody ahead of you, and there's something about we're competitors, and we see someone that we can overtake and pass. It gives you a sense of I've done something right here. I'm executing my plan. I wanted to be a rabbit hunter. I wanted to feel well. And you find somebody, you pass them. It gives you, from the time that you see them, and you build up, and you get past them, and you have to keep going. You can't stop in front of them. So you just keep going. And I find that those little leapfrogs help get through some of the miles from aid station to aid station. Yeah. Any agreement with that?
Oh, absolutely. You build momentum when you get a sense that you are picking up the pace.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're doing the right thing. This is pretty simple stuff. We're out there running 100 miles, and maybe 30 of that, you're running alone. You know, you're not seeing anybody or more. Then all of a sudden, let's say it's nighttime, and you see a light up ahead, and that light's getting a little bit brighter. You know, admittedly, I am a competitive guy, but we all are that are out there, and we see that light, and it is like a carrot, to go back to the rabbit analogy, and there is nothing more fun for me than to see that light getting a little closer, and it to take nothing away from that other runner. I wish them well.
Sure.
But they become the impetus for me to feel good about the fact that I'm doing the right thing up to that point.
Well, and this is a strategy that Don taught me this year when I was running, as he was pacing me, I was in miserable, miserable shape coming out of Forest Hill. My feet were terrible and I was not in a good place mentally. And as we started, the sun started to go down, or the sun was down. And as we started down the hill into the canyons, he would see that light ahead and he said, "Hey, there's a light. Let's go catch him." And that took my mind off of all of the pain and all of the, I'm feeling sorry for myself, wah, wah. And then we started, and he'd say, "Hey, we just passed two. Hey, let's go get another. Let's go get another one. Let's go get another one." And
that diversion may be really a big part of it.
It was a huge motivator and took my mind off a lot of the bad stuff that was happening.
I think I said, "Is that Lee or John up ahead?"
No, I think it's when I passed Lee, then I thought, "Oh my gosh, I'm I really am running fast now." But I also had a further motivation. I go, "I better try to get some distance on him, or he's going to come back and stomp on my liver."
And sometimes that's motivation too, right? If you pass somebody, that you need to keep it going and stay ahead. Now let's talk about overtaking a runner then. Because now we're getting deep into the workings in the mind of an ultra runner. You know, when do you pass, and do you make sure that you're feeling good before you pass? Do you hold back a little bit so you don't show weakness? Are we going to go there at all, guys?
No,
I think it's usually by that stage of the game, there's very little strategy employed. You just pass when it's naturally time to pass. They're usually happy to let you pass, and everybody's just kind of wishing each other well for the most part at that
sure,
point, you
yep.
know. So it is a fun indicator if you're catching people that that you're gaining momentum and that you're going to continue to improve your time. But all in all, it's kind of like unless your guy's going for the top 10, I'm sure they have a different take on this. But when you're back with the rest of us, it's a different group.
You know, I just want to interject real quick. John mentioned something that I've noticed being part of this ultra community that is different from shorter races that I've run, and that is the camaraderie when you are passing someone. You know, mm-hmm. usually say, "Hi, how's it going? Hey, looking good."
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see that same support structure in the shorter races that I've done. So I just wanted to mention that for those newbies out there that are listening to this podcast, that's part of this whole culture is you pass somebody or someone passes you, tell them, "Hey, good day to you."
And, yeah, that's right. Wish absolutely. Them well.
Yeah, although let me give a little bit of a different angle on this. This is the scene is Tahoe Rim 100 this past summer, last August. And we were creeping up on the first place and second place woman. And it was dark. It was about mile 85. And they were running together, the first and second place woman, and they had their pacers. And they were so tight next to one another. It just looked like four lights, one, two, three, four. And you could see that the competition that was going on there, the second place woman was watching every step of the first place woman.
Wow.
And to think that they probably, and again, I don't know this for certain, but that they must have been doing some version of that for the first 85 miles, I could not imagine, you know, the mental games that were going on. So we were glad to get away from that, but it was interesting to watch.
Yeah, like I said, I think it's different for those people at the front. Some folks say you kind of break the people in the event into three groups. You have the competitors, you have the runners, and you have the survivors, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think Lee and I are kind of in the runners group. I sometimes describe to folks, sometimes they think I post a pretty good time, but there's a really, really big gap between me and the elite runners. So I like to challenge myself to get in front of what I call the best of the rest group, right? You know,
well,
so
put.
I can get in front of most of the, on a really good day, I can get in front of most of the normal human beings, and then there's other folks who've just got a different set of gears than I was born with, but... I think you get up in those ones who are competing for a top 10 finish or competing to win the thing. They're playing an entirely different game, whereas the rest of us, we are just thumbing our nose at our own limitations and are hoping hoping that our fellow runner does well also.
Yeah, well put.
And only about 1% is put into actual thinking about race strategy, all that we're talking about today.
Yep.
But it is a huge percentage of your success that day. You know, again, stating the obvious, but if we train well, but then race day, we go out a little too fast, and all it means is a little too fast. The race is gone. All that training is for is for not from the perspective of you performing at your caliber. So race day, as we're talking about here, and consciously deciding what you're going to do ahead of time is paramount.
Now, we've put this into the context of a 100-mile event, but can it translate into to the 100K, to the 50-mile, to the 50K?
I think it certainly would. When you get more into the 50K, you are dealing more with a marathon-like speed race to where you're going to fuel differently and you're going to race differently. You start getting to the 50-mile zone, you are more into stage one and two of the race where you've got to try to make a pretty good time, and then you try to back it up with a negative split second half of the race. The 100-mile takes it to the different level to where what you did the first 30, 40 miles has such bearing on how you're going to be able to perform the last 30 to 40 miles. That's where I think it's really different. You can make some mistakes in a 50K or a 50-miler and respond mm-hmm. to them. Mm-hmm. The mistakes you have in a 100-miler come back to get you. You know, if you're even limping or compensating a little bit for some sort of minor injury, you'd be fine in a 50-miler. If you were compensating for some minor injury in a 100-miler, it might be mile 80, you flat out can't move anymore. You're stuck. You have some muscle that simply won't fire anymore. You know, those types of things where it becomes, you can just tough it out in a 50-miler and 100-miler. You can be as tough as you want, but, right, it's a, you know, like a million-dollar baby, girly tough isn't enough, right? In a 100-miler, you can think you're going to be mentally tough, but that last 20 miles, it's like, you know, sometimes you're just stuck with what happened, and you can be as mentally tough as you want, and you may have difficulty getting anything to respond. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's where, you know, a lot of the advice Lee was providing about staying away from that edge is so important early on, because it's just the consequences later on are different than they would be in a 50K and a 50-mile. Mm-hmm. Make a mistake in a 50-mile, it just means you're really suffering the last 10 miles. Mm-hmm. You make a mistake like that in a 100-mile, you might be just walking because you can't move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's wise at that point to listen to some aid station captains, listen to your pacer, because they, like you said, John, you stop thinking clearly at some point, especially if you're low on blood glucose or whatever else that might be, you know, impairing you. There's plenty to impair you.
Yeah, I remember in that 110 degree year in 2006, that was the time where I had the wheels just completely fall off at mile 70. My pacer, Drew Schooley, was telling me later on in the race, he says, go ahead and just hike this one. I said, no, I think I can run. No, every time you try to run and you slow down, it's embarrassing. You know, your pacer will tell you things like that. I remember getting to mile 90, and I'm like, oh, gosh, Drew, it's 3:30 a.m., and it's still unbelievably hot out here. And he goes, well, buddy, it's sun's going to come up in about an hour and a half, and it's just going to get hotter, so you might as well man up and get on down the trail.
That's the kind of pacer you want to have.
It's just kind of, yeah.
You know, guys, we could talk for hours, because I have questions and items that I'd love to talk to you about. So I'd love to do this again sometime and come up with some of these topics inside the head of an ultra runner, you know, and how to create the strategy. So it'd be great to have you come back.
Yeah. Good. Thank you, Lee, and thank you, John, for coming and being on the program today. You know, after we post this podcast, there's room for comments. I'm sure there's a lot of very experienced runners out there that have some input. So make sure that you comment on the comment section of the podcast. If you're downloading it from iTunes, head over to the website, trailrunnernation.com. Go to the podcast tab and enter your comments there. We'd love to hear from you. And while you're there, you might as well join the nation, learn something, share something, and go out and run.